you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur. Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 148 of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyra, your host, as usual. Today, I have a really interesting guest, Margot Thomas. Margot is a solo practitioner here in the Washington, D.C. area, Northern Virginia, to be exact. And she does primarily commercial business litigation. And I just thought as a solo practitioner, it'd be really interesting because most of our solos in the past have been estate planners or family law or personal injury, you know, some of those kind of typical practice areas that lend themselves, I think, for one reason or another to solo practice. But Margot's been doing, as I said, business, commercial business litigation, and primarily on the defense side, as you'll hear. And so I think it's an interesting kind of different perspective on opening a practice. You'll see hear how she went through the trials and tribulations of doing so, including managing to open a solo practice with twins on the way. So I can't think of anything more stressful than that. So it's an interesting story. So I hope you enjoy listening to Margot Thomas. Margot Thomas, welcome to The Law Entrepreneur.
I'm happy to be here.
Well, it's a delight to have you on this beautiful spring day here in the Washington, D.C. area. For those who haven't been following our weather, it was 6 degrees a few days ago, and it's 60 degrees today. So, yes. You know, go figure. Anyway, Margot, I'm thrilled that you have taken the time to be with us today. Tell our audience a little bit about yourself and how you came to be where you are today.
So I am, I have a law firm in Northern Virginia and practice in Virginia, Maryland, and D.C., and I do all commercial business litigation, which basically boils down to helping businesses resolve their contract disputes. I only do litigation, and I have only done litigation since the beginning of my career back in 07. And it's primarily on the defense side. So I'm just helping clients when they've got a demand letter, they receive a demand letter or get served with a lawsuit or are on the verge of one of those two things happening. And I just help them resolve those claims, which are usually breach of contract claims, lease disputes, non-compete issues, tortious interference claims, even business partnership disputes.
So that's a fair amount of litigation, right? I mean, you're in the courts a lot?
Yes. Almost 1 or 2 days a week, I'm in court. So a large amount of my time is either preparing for court or being in court for hearings or trials.
Now, being a reformed litigator myself, you know, a lot of family law and even personal injury law, which is what I used to do, a lot of those cases never really make it to court. The vast majority of them settle in one fashion or another. You still have to be prepared to try the case if need be. But a lot of them, and sometimes, you know, it's right up till the typical settlement on the courthouse steps. Is that also true in commercial business law? That's always been a question of mine. My sense is that more of your type of cases go to litigation as a percentage of the overall volume than say, in a family law. Am I mistaken there?
Not many of the cases go to trial. But there tends to be a lot of pretrial motions and discovery and a number of hearings. But 99% of my cases settle at some point, and it may be on the courthouse steps, like you said, or early on. But it's usually just a lot of hearings and motions and preparing for trial. But this year, I've actually already had 2 trials, so that kind of throws off the percentages a little bit. But, you know, you never know.
I wonder if just because of the nature of the cases themselves, whether or not you know, there's a lot of systems in place to try and get families in particular, or even in personal injury, I guess, you know, claimants and insurance companies. There's a lot of programs in place to try and make that happen, make those settlements occur. When you're talking about a business or business-to-business kind of litigation, I wonder if the same type of efforts to try and promote settlement exist.
Yeah,
I'm showing my ignorance here, yeah. Clearly.
Yes, there are. We use a lot of private mediation. And sometimes in federal court, they have magistrates that mediate cases. So I also spend a fair amount of time in mediation or arbitration trying to resolve disputes before they go to trial. So there are a lot of avenues, depending on the amount in dispute, which are available to try to get parties to resolve things sooner rather than later and save everyone some money.
Yeah. So is this an area, a practice area that you felt you always wanted to pursue? Or were you, when you went to law school, did you have loftier or different ideas about what kind of practice you were going to have when you got out of law school?
Well, I can tell you when I went to law school, I had no idea what I wanted to do. I just didn't want to get a job.
Right, none of us did.
That was my only objective. I was young and I went straight from college to law school. And I just thought that that was an easier road than working at the time. So when I got to law school, I really fell in love with criminal law.
Yep.
And a criminal law professor that I had was really good. And I was applying to all criminal law jobs and thought that I would end up at a, you know, public defender or a state's attorney's office somewhere, and yeah, got some offers to go in that direction. But I also got an offer to join a big law firm and do commercial litigation. And, you know, it really came down to money at the end of the day. I just had, you know, an exorbitant amount of law school loans, and it just, you know, made sense. And, you know, I hadn't really had too much experience in either one. But, you know, I knew I wanted to be in court and not sitting behind a desk most of the day. So I went with the big law firm job and I loved it. I really do love being in court and litigation. I never really looked back.
Well, that's terrific. I mean, again, similar kind of path. I spent most of my time in law school thinking I was going to put bad guys in jail and interned at the state's attorney's office and thought that's exactly what I was going to do. And at the very last second had a crisis of confidence and said, you know, maybe I want to just look around. And so that led me in a different direction. So how long did you stay in Big Law?
9 years.
Oh, wow.
9 years. Yeah.
Good long time. And a downtown firm?
Both of the firms are in Tysons Corner.
Okay.
One was a Maryland-based firm, but they were both mid-Atlantic firms. So they had offices all over DC, Maryland, Virginia, North Carolina, that area.
So then what led you to the solo entrepreneurial track?
You know, I got pregnant with my twins in
2013. That'll do it. That'll do it. Damn kids every time, right? Yeah,
that changed the trajectory of my career dramatically, to say the least. But it was a very difficult pregnancy. I was in the hospital for a very long time. I was on bed rest for a very long time.
Oh, dear.
And it, you know, just, it gives you a lot of time to think about what you want to do going forward. And I knew that I loved practicing law and I loved being in court, but, you know, there were hesitations I had about whether the big firm was where I wanted to be, you know, for an indefinite future. In fact, when I started at the big law firm, I kind of knew this wasn't the end or, you know, how I saw myself. I mean,
yeah,
it just wasn't what I defined success to be in my mind. So after my kids turned 2, you know, I've been talking to my husband forever about, you know, I think I can do this. I think I can do this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the door just opened and I ran through it and, you know, I'm here now.
Yeah. I just can't imagine. You know, women have a particularly difficult challenge in the practice of law because, you know, the reality of becoming a mom. And I just can't imagine being on forced bed rest with the knowledge that this works out okay. I'm going to be delivering twins.
Yeah.
And how am I going to manage that? Hard enough managing one new child, but two at a time and a, you know, a career in big law. I suspect your stress level was somewhere around the roof.
It was. I think it is a very difficult balancing act. I mean, I think it certainly can be done. And I see lots of women who take that path and balance it.
And handle it great.
Great. You know, but I knew that's not what I wanted to do. When I went back after my maternity leave, I remember, you know, this rush to get dressed and get my kids dressed and get them to daycare. And then I had this commute. And then, you know, I didn't have time to talk to anybody. I was not the water, you know, I wasn't at the water cooler. I was in there to bill some hours and get home as quickly as I could so that I could see my kids before they went to bed. And
you got stuff to do.
Yeah. And that's not what I wanted to do. You know, I wasn't happy doing that. And I didn't feel like I would truly excel in the big law firm practice doing that because a lot happens after 5 p.m. and on weekends. And I wasn't ready or willing to put in the time after work and go to lunches and because that took away from my billable hour day and that's how you're judged. And I just there weren't enough hours in the day to meet those standards. So I knew that something had to change.
So you see this door on the horizon and it says the law offices of Margot Thomas. And you decided to crash through it. How much planning did you said you talked to your husband about it for a while? How much planning did you do to prep for that rush through the door?
Probably a year or so.
Oh, good for you.
There was another partner at one of the firms that I worked at who was also looking to take the leap. And we, you know, met with a business advisor and went over a budget and got equipment and, you know, came up with a logo and did all of the, you know, nuts and bolts things to start a law practice. So we talked about that for a good amount of time before.
So did you start with a partner?
You know, actually, about a month or two before we were going to open the doors of the law practice, he decided not to leave.
Oh, okay.
So it was a huge... It was a huge decision, to say the least, after that happened, because so much had, you know, went in. And you feel some sense of comfort having someone else take the leap with you. You're not alone. So, you know, that was huge.
Not to draw the analogy out too far, but when I was in college, a whole bunch of folks went to go leap out of an airplane to do some parachuting. We all went up the airplane, and only one of us got up there and said, you know, I'm staying in the plane. So I can relate with your friend. So it does seem to be quite a leap, so to speak. All right, so you jump out with your own parachute, and that's it. And you knew, was there any thought about maybe changing practice areas, or did you know that your best chance for success continued to be in commercial business law?
You know, that's a great question because I actually, when I left the firm, I thought I'm going to switch sides. I was primarily doing defense type of work, commercial litigation, but for defending banks against Fair Credit Reporting Act claims and Fair Debt Collection Act, FDCPA claims. And I thought, you know, I want to be a plaintiff's attorney. I think I'll love that. You know, I should know so much about that from being on the other side. You know, they say
potentially more variety.
Right. And, you know, they say that prosecutors make the best defense attorneys, you know, so I
for
thought,
sure. Mm-hmm.
You know, switching sides would be, you know, what I would do. And then I got out there and started, you know, doing that kind of work. And I was like, you know, I really miss the defense side. I really miss the business disputes that I was doing. So, you know, I kind of went back to where it all started and went back to commercial litigation.
This episode of The Law Entrepreneur is sponsored by Daylight. Daylight is the Mac CRM and case management tool I've been using for years to manage my practice. If you're feeling swamped trying to keep track of cases and clients, but you don't want to pay the hefty price tag of something like Salesforce or other legal-specific tools, I recommend you give Daylight a look. Daylight helps me prioritize my day. It helps me keep track of my clients, cases, documents, emails, calendars, to-dos, and reminders, all in one place. The case management part of Daylight makes it really easy to organize all the details and work for each case so things are done on time. The best part of Daylight is that it lets you work offline. You don't need an internet connection to pull up case details or info about a client like with other CRMs and case management tools. And new in Daylight is their Zapier integration, so you can automate things like pulling new leads from a contact form on your website right into Daylight. And for techies like me, you know that Integration with tools like Zapier is really fundamental to making something like Daylight work the way you want it to work. So to learn how Daylight can help you grow your practice, visit marketcircle.com/daylight. Be sure to let them know you heard about Daylight through The Law Entrepreneur to get a 50% discount on your first month subscription. That's Daylight by Market Circle. The legal environment is more competitive than ever, and small law firms are feeling the pinch. With over 1.3 million attorneys in the United States and counting, it can be hard to stand out from the crowd. And that's why Spotlight Branding helps lawyers become unforgettable. Spotlight Branding is a different kind of internet marketing company. They don't put their clients on the SEO hamster wheel, and they don't ask them to burn thousands of dollars on speculative pay-per-click advertising. Instead, they're focused on the fundamentals of legal marketing that have worked for dozens upon dozens of years. They use the internet to build a premium brand for solo and small firm lawyers like myself, and they put systems in place to create top-of-mind awareness, allowing their clients to maximize the referrals and repeat business. It's the smart way to grow your law firm. To get more information, visit spotlightbranding.com/TLE, as in The Law Entrepreneur, and receive a special gift from our friends there at Spotlight Branding. Spotlight Branding, helping lawyers become unforgettable. Support for today's episode comes from Ruby Receptionists, dedicated to helping you grow your practice one happy caller at a time. From their offices in Portland, Oregon, Ruby's live remote receptionists create an exceptional experience for your callers by answering calls live with your custom greeting, delighting callers in English or Spanish, transferring calls, taking messages, collecting new client intake, and much more. Just like an in-house receptionist at a fraction of the cost. For 15 years, Ruby has been turning rings into relationships. For more information, call 844-895-7829 or visit callruby.com/lawentrepreneur. When you started, you had this 1 year taxi to get the plans together. Tell us about that process. You said you went and met with the business coach and you did all these things. When you got ready to open the doors, was it a physical space that you opened, or did you work from the kitchen table to start with? How did you actually create the law offices of Margo Thomas?
You know, before I started, I talked to a lot of people, and the best advice I think I got was, you know, keep it as slim as you can at the beginning. You know, if you go and start signing leases and bringing in employees, you know, you're going to have overhead that is going to be very stressful and make it very difficult to succeed. And for me, so I took that literally. I was like, you know, I'll work on my kitchen table. I'm not signing a lease. I didn't hire anybody. You know, I even thought, you know, as much time as I spend on legal research databases, I thought I'll just go to the law library and use their legal research because it's free there. I was at an extreme level of I'm not spending any money because I had two kids. I had a mortgage. I had a car note. You know, I needed to make enough money to replace the salary from Big Law, not, you know, spend money on, you know, an office space or things that are great, but wouldn't necessarily aren't needed in order to practice law. So I was focusing on that and just, you know, my salary and how I was going to replace that. So I wanted all my money to kind of go into my pocket so I could pay those bills.
Sure. And then the challenge is, you know, you want to project this image as an attorney that you can support your clients and that you can meet their needs. At the same time, you're running things on a shoestring. That creates a little bit of a, you know, attention in and of itself. Did your client base change much? Did you downsize in terms of the, you know, the size of the client that you were representing, or was it, well, you know, full steam ahead, everything the same?
Well, the interesting fact is a lot of people, when I told them I wanted to leave, said, well, you know, do you have a book of business that you're going to take with you? And I said, no, I don't. And they were like, well, you know, when I left and started my firm, I had, you know, 10 clients that came with me. So I knew that I was going to be making, you know, X amount of money as soon as I started. And I said, well, I don't, but you know, I'm going to take the risk anyway. And I feel like if I'm forced into the situation where it's develop business or, you know, to feed my family, I'll figure it out. And I knew that if I pushed myself to that limit, I would figure it out because I wasn't doing a lot of, you know, rainmaking when I was at the firm. I was more just, you know, just trying to crank out the work. Yeah. So, you know, I started and I didn't have any potential clients, but one of the clients, one of the bigger clients, one of the biggest clients I was working for at the firm left and worked with me after I left.
Okay.
So that was huge, but you know, it didn't require a ton of resources because I was able to, you know, it was a lot of client meetings. It was a lot of motion drafting. It wasn't a ton of resources weren't needed to continue doing that work. And the firm that I had left also stayed on with the case as well. So, you know, they had their resources that they pulled. And, you know, I didn't burn any bridges with those firms. So, you know, to the extent I needed a conference room, you know, I could rely upon them, or the extent I needed to call in any favors, they were there. But, you know, I've never really seen that as a barrier. A lot of my clients, I don't meet in person. They have such a short time frame to respond and are desperate almost to find an attorney. And a lot of my cases come from referrals. So once someone says, this is the person you need to talk to, they can help you. A lot of the people that, you know, I find as my clients aren't like, well, you know, let me interview you and come to your office and see, you know, what it looks like. You know, I can talk to them on the phone and convey that I know what I'm doing and have the experience to do it. And they go with it.
It's interesting because, you know, when talking to all the solos that we talked to on this program, solos and small firm practitioners, you know, the number of people who came from Big Law and brought the book with them, it's probably like 50-50, I think, just anecdotally, I would say that. And the feedback that I get from some of the listeners is, well, geez, if I could have carried half my book or with me from Big Law or medium-sized law, there wouldn't be any risk to starting a solo practice. A piece of cake. I've got the guaranteed income. I think people relate to folks like yourself who don't have that safety net and have to figure it out, as you said, on your own, because that's at least 50% of the solo market, or maybe more. I don't know. I'm just speaking anecdotally from the people that I've interviewed. So I think that's a real challenge. And usually, it's not a question of how do I get the work done. I know how to get the work done. I've been doing the work. The question usually is, where are the clients going to come from?
Exactly.
So how did you answer that question? Where do the clients come from? You said that most of your work came from referrals. How have you fostered that system, and what else have you done to generate business?
Just staying in touch with my contacts. I think that the firms that I work for are great resources, and, you know, they frequently have cases that, you know, they consider too small or they are conflicted out of. And being, you know, on their speed dial when that happens has been, you know, a blessing to my practice. So, you know, just maintaining those relationships and staying top of mind with those people has been huge. But, you know, I also get a lot of, I get a fair amount of work from the internet, just being on sites like Avvo and, you know, updating my website and doing blogs and being on LinkedIn and speaking at, you know, conferences and things like that. Just updating my website with all of that information has also brought in a fair amount of work.
So one of the things that always interests me is when people say, I just keep those relationships fresh. I keep working those relationships and stay top of mind. How does that manifest itself to you? I mean, what are you doing to keep yourself top of mind with those established referral sources? And how do you work that connection?
Pick up the phone and say, do you want to go to lunch? And what's going on? And how's your practice treating you? And just ask a lot of questions. And I think that that's the best way to stay in touch with people. Email marketing is one thing, but, you know, people are so inundated with emails these days that, you know, I feel like it's got to be something more, you have to be face-to-face with people to really have that connection. So, you know, I go to a lot of lunches. In fact, Neil, I think that's how we met.
Indeed. Indeed.
So let's go to lunch. So I do a lot of lunches to meet more people, develop new referral sources, and stay you know, in contact with my existing referral sources.
I'm actually rereading a book right now that was written by a guest of ours back on episode 112, none other than the well-known Neen James. And she wrote a book called Attention Pays. And it makes exactly that point, that intentional attention to our referral sources and to the people who are we're connected to in our business is the way to stay in that relationship and to foster that relationship. And if you outsource that attention to things like email and, you know, a text message every once in a while, you're just not going to get the same results.
I agree with that completely.
You did a lot of things right along the way. Did you do everything right? I mean, anything that you look back on, you say, boy, that was a mistake, or I wish I'd done that differently, or what were some of the lessons you learned along the way?
I picked up a lot of lessons along the way. I wish I could say I didn't make any mistakes, but that would be a lie. I mean, you know, I think the biggest obstacle that I faced was, like I said, my the partner that I was going to start the firm with.
Rely on you.
And choosing that relationship. And, you know, I caveat that by saying, the business partner that I was intending to open this business with is, you know, a phenomenal attorney that has been a mentor to me and is still a very close friend. But, you know, when he decided to pull out of our practice, you know, I really was about to throw in the towel. And, you know, it really affected my confidence. And, you know, I can't do this alone, you know, and what will happen? It's now all on me. So, you know, if one of us did well, that may be able to, you know, help the ship from sinking. But, you know, now it is all on me. And, you know, if I don't make it, it's going to be, you know, I was just catastrophizing the whole situation. Mm-hmm. So it's just, you know, I see a lot of people who go into business partnerships and for one reason or another, they don't work out. And I think that that has been my biggest learning lesson around, you know, the practice of law and opening this firm is that, you know, you can't let that affect it. This is, I feel like, my destiny to, you know, open this firm. And, you know, this is what I feel like I should be doing. And that decision to go into that partnership almost prevented me from, you know, being where I am today.
So, yeah, or at least caused you to give pause. And, you know, I think you're kind of like a lot of folks that you don't want to have to look back 20 years from now and say, what if I had gone out on my own, you know, when I wanted to. So that's a good point to remember. So are you still working from the kitchen table or has that evolved?
So I probably have a more, a less traditional office environment. I actually have a physical office in Fairfax, but I work from home primarily. Just because of commuting, and I now have 3 small children, so it just saves me a ton of time. But my assistant works from the Fairfax office, so it's nice having a place where, you know, our files and mail and phone system gets routed through, and there's someone, you know, at the door to the extent, you know, people are dropping off things, and he makes it work from that avenue. But I probably go maybe once or twice a month, and it's usually around meeting clients there, and it's near the Fairfax courthouse, so it's convenient if I'm in hearings and things like that.
I had a person say to me that, well, the law firm lives here, but I work here.
Yes.
I thought that was an interesting way of looking at it. And of course, you know, today with technology being such as it is, we can do that. 10 years ago, that was really difficult to do, to work remotely. And so it's just really almost a no-brainer for solos and small firm practitioners now.
Yes. Yeah.
So you say you have an assistant. Tell us about your staffing. Is that the extent of your staffing? And if so, you know, where do you see yourself going in the next couple of years or so?
So I have an of-counsel attorney that I work with a lot who has also worked with me in one of the firms, the big law firms. He was the managing partner of one of the firms that I used to work at. So we work together on a number of matters. And over the last 3 years, in my firm, I've had a number of counsel people come in and go out for numerous reasons. But at this point, my next step is to hire an associate, which I have been, you know, interviewing for and trying to, you know, get the ball rolling on that. I mean, the goal is to, you know, scale the business and bring in a few more attorneys and, you know, expand the reach of the firm.
Yeah, well, it sounds exciting. It sounds like you're well on your way to doing so.
Yes, also scary, but well, exciting at the same time.
Of course, if it wasn't scary, though, who would do it?
Right.
So, Margo, tell our audience how they could reach out to you if they want to follow up on anything you've touched upon today.
My email is mthomas@thomaslawplc.com. thomaslawplc.com is the website. And I can be reached by phone. Just pick up the phone and give me a call. I'm, you know, available and would love to speak about any of these issues. It's 703-957-2577.
That's perfect. We'll have all of that in our show notes. And listen, I look forward to the next time we have lunch together. And hopefully we'll have you back on the show and you can tell us about how the law offices of Margo Thomas are continuing to expand over there on the other side of the river.
Yes, I'd love that. Thank you.
All right. That sounds great, Margo. Thanks so much for being on The Law Entrepreneur.
Thank you.
Once again, I'd like to thank our sponsors for today's episode of The Law Entrepreneur, Ruby Receptionists. They, along with our old friends at Spotlight Branding, as well as Market Circle, the makers of Daylight, are the ones that make this podcast possible, and for them, I am very grateful. So please be sure to visit their websites. You can find the locations in the show notes for this episode of The Law Entrepreneur, or you can go to our website, thelawentrepreneur.com, and navigate to the resources page, and there you can find a way to get to each of their websites. So please visit their websites, sign on as clients. I'm a client now of all three, and I think you'll be happy you did so. So that's Ruby Receptionists, Spotlight Branding, and Market Circle, the makers of Daylight.